You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on Saturday, the 22nd of June 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Marcus Hippie.
Coming up on today's programme, we are going big on film. First up, broadcast editor Lisa Campbell will be here to give us the lowdown on this year's International Documentary Festival in Sheffield.
When I went outside in the morning, the scene was devastating. The Sri Lankan government were targeting the civilian population.
And we'll also be asking whether Richard Linklater's much-awaited third instalment of Celine and Jesse in Before Midnight has been worth the wait.
You never stop ogling girls.
Like... I don't ogle girls. I make love to them with my eyes.
Oh, wow. I'm stuck with an American teenager.
Plus, we'll talk you through a great weekend in Athens and welcome Norwegian curator and producer Mattis Witt for this week's music review.
So, lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. Very happy Saturday to you, Marcus.
Hello, Hugo. How are you doing today?
Very good indeed. I bet you'd probably rather be... enjoying some midsummer celebrations in Helsinki.
I don't think this is a bad alternative for the Nordic midsummer party celebration. It's actually, the review is actually quite a nice program to work with, isn't it?
Exactly, mind-altering in its own way. You this week went to see the Pet Shop Boys.
It's been a busy week, but actually I managed to squeeze in a bit of culture this week. I saw my old favourite. You know, the first C cassette I ever bought was by Pet Shop Boys, and I actually got to see them for the second time in my life on Tuesday at the O2 Arena. And it's really funny, the first time when I saw them, I thought that they are relatively old gentlemen already, so there can't be a lot of action on the stage. I was expecting them to be, you know, somewhat lazy.
Pushing a Zimmer frame. They're not that old, are they?
No, actually, both the times I've been so surprised and so overwhelmed by how amazing show they can come up with. And I saw them for the first time now in England, in London. And I think that also carried a special significance considering where they are from. And when they played Western Girls, it just... drove the whole audience crazy. That's, in a way, that's such a love song for London.
It's so good that they have absolutely stood the test of time and also reach a new audience as well.
And when you listen to the music, they actually always manage to come up with different versions of the songs, kind of modernising them slightly so that they never sound old. I think that's quite amazing as well.
Well, the Pet Shop Boys, they're playing at the O2 in London this week. Sadly, I didn't get a chance to go. I haven't really been that cultural myself. I have been indulging in sales shopping.
Indeed.
By way of, I don't know if you can really...
Have you managed to buy anything cultural?
I've been stocking up on a summer wardrobe for myself, courtesy of Selfridges, which is just down the road from Midori House. And yes, I suppose you could call it art, the art of shopping.
Absolutely. We have a great show ahead, by the way.
Yes, we do. Let's get on with it now. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24.
The northern English city of Sheffield, once the industrial heartland of the UK, is now one of the greenest urban spaces in the country. Hugging the eastern side of the Peak District National Park, it began to bloom, like many northern cities during the 1990s and 2000s. Sheffield found a pride in its industrial heritage and a new identity as a student hub and home of a thriving indie music scene which gave birth to Britpop global superact Pulp.
But in recent years, it's also become recognised as host of the UK's leading international documentary festival, otherwise known as Sheffield DocFest. 2013 marked its 20th anniversary, and the event wrapped up a few days ago. Broadcast editor and review regular Lisa Campbell was there, and she joins us in the studio now to talk us through which titles got people talking and what we should be watching over the coming months. Welcome back to The Review, Lisa.
Hello.
So back from Sheffield, and it seems that there's one film that's probably on people's lips more than any other.
Yes, The Act of Killing actually won the Special Jury Prize and is the film that has been hailed by critics around the world as the film of the year. Werner Herzog has described it as the most frightening film he's ever seen. He was producer on the film, and Errol Morris, the great documentary maker, is also, singling this out. And it's out next week. It's also part of the Open Doc Fest, which is happening in London at the moment. So if anyone's around this afternoon, they could get down there and hear a Q&A with the director. But yeah, it's disturbing. I will.
Do you want to tell us more in detail what it's all about?
Yeah. It follows the year of Indonesia's coup in 1965, which saw the murder of more than a million communists. In fact, these are enemies of the military, including ethnic Chinese and intellectuals. And the film really breaks a 40-year silence about these killings. And the director, Joshua Oppenheimer, he began by interviewing the victims. And then he came across the perpetrators. Notably Anwar, the head of a gang of killers called the Frog Squad, and he tortured and killed about 1,000 people himself. The director discovered that Anwar and his friends were not only keen to tell of their crimes with great passion, but to reenact them via these quite beautiful cinematic reconstructions. So it is the most bizarre way of telling a story.
That sounds actually quite horrific, watching a film where they show what they've done, basically. How did you feel yourself when you watched all that?
Well, really, really disturbed in the beginning. And I was thinking, why are they doing this? Is this glamorising atrocities? I don't understand it. As you start to watch the film, you start to understand what is going on. And it's actually quite deep. You know, he's sort of playing these mind games, really, with the perpetrators. He's giving them a rope with which to hang themselves. He's helping them to really confront what they've done and start to feel remorse, and so they do at the end of the film. But I mean, it's interesting. It starts with a quote from Voltaire, which said, "It's forbidden to kill. Therefore, all murderers are punished, unless they kill in large numbers and to the sound of trumpets." So these guys were really seen as heroes by, you know, the local population at the time as well. So, I mean, it is incredible, and you know, I think the director talks more about this, really, and really sort of helps to explain it. And it does become clear as you watch the film, as I've said. But he says, "You celebrate mass killing so you don't have to look yourself in the mirror in the morning and see a murderer. You keep your victims oppressed so that they don't challenge your story. When you put the justification, the celebration, under a microscope, you don't necessarily see a lack of remorse, but you start to see an unravelling of the killer's conscience. So what appears to be the symptom of a lack of remorse is in fact the opposite. It's a sign of their humanity."
And you mentioned there the fact that there is some form of remorse in Anwar and the killers as the documentary unfolds. But do you leave feeling absolute sort of abject hatred and horror at the events, which you can't really sort of distance the action from as well?
You do, absolutely. And, then there's a scene where they get the local population to reenact the sort of killings, and the children are involved, and a lot of children were killed at the time, and then the houses burnt down. And the children are really upset at the end of filming, you know, even though it's just a film. And it's, you know, so it's really heartrending. You can really feel the pain and how these people were tortured. But it's really fascinating how much you start to, never understand the mind of the killer, but he's not the monster. You can't just sort of categorise a murderer as they're a monster, they're a bad person, I can put them in that, you know, prison and don't have to deal with it. It's quite fascinating, the relationship you sort of end up having, and certainly the director ends up having with this mass murderer. And actually they speak regularly now by Skype, sort of once a week. They've sort of got to this point. I mean, it's very hard to describe how you could get to that point, but I think sort of seeing the film, it's such a different way of highlighting a horrendous thing that, you know, we've not really talked about for years and years.
When director of this film, Josh Oppenheimer, spoke, did you hear him mention anything about what he feels, what the significance of this film is for Indonesia and Indonesia dealing with its history?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of it is about, you know, the Western world sort of stood by and let this happen and sort of supported it indirectly. I mean, I think a lot of the films that we saw at Sheffield had, there's sort of a campaigning element to films, like a real sort of call to action. I think there's, there is a website that you can go and look at. You can get involved in the film and the debate, and sort of help it have a life beyond that. Which is a similar story with the other film, which was also quite disturbing and dealing with an atrocity in Sri Lanka. So, and that one's called
No Fire Zone.
No Fire Zone. Yes, and. This tells the story of the killing fields of Sri Lanka, and this is a more recent thing. This happens at the end of 2009, 2008, 2009, in which thousands of Tamil people were killed in Sri Lanka.
We actually do have a clip of that film. I think this would be a right moment to listen to it.
All of a sudden, bullets were coming, like firing right into the people. We all left knowing that they're going to die. There's nothing we can do.
The government were determined to finish the LTTE off militarily, no matter what it cost, including in civilian lives. They didn't believe that anybody in the international community was prepared to stop them, and they were right.
That's a clip of No Fire Zone dealing with the Sri Lankan civil war there. Again, quite heavy.
Yeah, this actually started life as a documentary that was broadcast on Channel 4, and it was made by the news team. And it features, it's footage, a lot of it is footage taken by people on their mobile phones at the time. And it even includes footage from soldiers who, you know, and really how their victims were war trophies. And there's some really shocking footage. In fact, at the time, I think it was the most horrific content that Channel 4 had ever broadcast. And the Sri Lankan government sort of, you know, came back hard, denied everything, said the footage was fake, you know, it just completely denied it. So this is a follow-up film. This is a theatrical release. It's got more evidence. It's had everything verified by forensic scientists. It's compelling. It's undeniable that it happened. And you know, the kind of breach of international law is incredible. You know, it was started off, you know, it's a battle with the Tamil Tigers. Civilians can go to this no-fire zone. They'll be safe there. They had hospitals. The International Red Cross sent their, you know, the GPS coordinates. And within an hour, they were being shelled. And there was just, you know, 65 times this happened where hospitals were bombed as soon as they were saying, you know, don't kill us. We're here in this no fire zone, and it's really shocking. It's sort of, you know, the world isn't aware of what happened. There's been no justice. It was actually nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize last year, and I think, you know, people were pointing out that it really sort of highlights the failure of the UN institutions. You know, increasingly, its failure to safeguard human life and prevent brutal wars, and the contribution of this documentary brings this to light. You know, the failure in the context of this war, but also about the need for reviewing and revitalizing the UN's capacity.
Absolutely.
In cases similar
be more
to this.
Timely with what's going on in Syria at the moment.
Yeah,
well.
That's right.
But Lisa, I want to open it up a little bit and talk about the documentary festival itself in Sheffield. And, you know, presumably this wasn't your first time there. Definitely
no.
Not your first time at a documentary film festival.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I love this festival. It's got a real buzz about it. It's also, I mean, it's big now. It's about the third largest in the world. So there's 3,000 delegates from around 60 countries. There are screenings, masterclasses, debates, and it really seems to attract the documentary purist as well. So there's often very passionate and heated debates about the role of directors. And this year, there's a suggestion that the power of the director is diminishing, that their role is being marginalised, and that's having an effect on the quality of films.
Why would that be happening?
Well, I think really they're talking about documentary series. There's a rise of a producer editor, or predator, as some people call them, who's basically cutting the film and going into the edit suite, and it's becoming, they're shaping the film, it's their vision, and you know, rather than the directors. And it's really about time and budget constraints, and there just isn't the money nowadays to have the director doing it all. It's not so much an issue with the single docs as much, but there's less room in the schedules for them. But I think what, you know, probably people out there would agree with, if you're watching these doc series, these sort of observational docs set in hospitals or schools or following the police, and they're very formulaic, they feel very derivative and indistinguishable, sort of docs by numbers. We know where we're going to end up before anyone has even picked up a camera. You know, where's the genuine journey of discovery? And there's too many sort of predetermined shooting scripts and too few evolving narratives. And so there was one particularly heated debate where, you know, we were reminded of Hitchcock's line, which is in feature films, the director is God. In documentary, God is the director. So I think there's a urge to get back to that.
Does part of it also have something to do with people's concentration spans that have been maybe weakened slightly thanks to the big beast of the internet, which is a different platform that, you know, as much as it opens up.
And interestingly, there are more films being shown online, you know, with sites like Vice. And the boss of Vice was there at the festival and saying, you know, at one point they'd get a lot of traffic for sort of humorous clips of cats or something. Whereas now they're putting quite hard-hitting films online and getting an incredible response. And if they do put something funny on, then people are saying, mm-hmm. you know, they're slated by their audience. There's a real thirst for serious factual. And I think it really works online because films can have a line. If they, you know, something like No War Zone, you can see at the cinema, or The Act of Killing, but they have a life beyond the screen now via social media. So you can really get involved in the campaign. You can follow, you know, activity on Twitter. You can help with the funding. So, you know, in many ways, it's quite an amazing time for documentary makers to really sort of give their films the attention via. Via online, they're not getting that attention in TV.
Exactly. I was just saying that it's interesting that there is demand online, but actually it's quite hard to get the documentary films on television nowadays.
Yeah. People would rather put their marketing and publicity into a big series. They know they're going to get decent ratings. It's very easy for single films to just get lost in the schedule and not have the impact that the channel needs them to have, sadly.
Lisa, Sheffield itself, it's a brilliant thing that it's managed to harness this doc festival into being such a big draw for people all over the world, because Sheffield obviously has huge history that then suffered quite Great Depression when it lost its industrial prowess. But how does it feel as a city now?
It's great. I think it's been really regenerated. There's some beautiful buildings in Sheffield. Great new bars. It feels sort of quite cutting edge. I mean, there's quite a strong filmmaking community there, and as you said, the music scene is great. It feels like a real creative hotspot, I think.
It's so nice. I can't wait to go.
Exactly.
Marcus, you haven't been, have you?
I haven't been, but I definitely want to go after this.
Maybe we'll do an outside
for the next festival.
Broadcast from Sheffield soon. Lisa Campbell, thank you so much for joining us today on The Review. You're listening to Monocle 24, where after the break, we'll be getting the global cultural lowdown from our Toronto bureau chief. Stay tuned.
Come with us from
Georgia
before we zip to
Istanbul
on Route 4. As we meet the people who are charting, finessing, celebrating and refreshing our metropolises.
You have to design a street for the speed at which a human being walks rather than for the automobile.
If you're trying to look at this place as an organ, it doesn't get enough blood. So it's on the verge of a heart attack, I'd say.
What's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city.
The Urbanist is Monocle 24's show about the cities we live in, that delivers insights into city halls, the views from the tops of towers, the stories of hidden rivers, and discovers why we still love that brutalist old beast, concrete.
Everything we use, touch, and our entire economy is based upon nature. The only difference now is that we tend to be less able to see that because we're living in a world of concrete, glass, and steel.
The Urbanist, presented by me, Andrew Tuck, premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time.
How far is the park? Does the park have a place where they can sit? Does the park have shade for them?
Join your fellow city lovers and leave the countryside to the people who prefer barns to bars and quiet walks to sidewalks.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi, and Hugo MacDonald. It's that time of the week where we cross to Nelly Gotcheva, now our Toronto bureau chief, to hear what cultural highlights she's recommended to us from around the world this weekend.
This weekend in Toronto, Pictou Gallery is hosting Interchanges, an exhibition by Peter Andrew Lushtek, displaying his breathtaking photos of highways in Toronto, Montreal and Phoenix. All shots were taken from above on a slow-moving plane. Lushtek continues his work on the project with more photos of the roads in Europe to follow. Interchanges is at the Pictou Gallery until the end of July. In Tokyo, the Nezu Museum showcases a special selection of Chinese and Korean ceramics and classic ukiyo-e prints. This is the largest exhibition to be brought to Tokyo from Hagi Uragami Museum's permanent collection in the Yamaguchi Prefecture. Don't miss a walk in the traditional Japanese gardens of the museum, dotted with statues and old tea ceremony houses. The works are on display until the 15th of July. Over the coming 2 weeks, London will be celebrating Arab culture. Kicking off this weekend, the Shubak Festival opens with a concert of Algerian rock and roll icon Rashid Taha at the Barbican Centre. The festival is spread over various locations in London and features 100 Arab artists such as Libyan novelist Hisham Matar, Iraqi painter Mahmoud Sabri and Syrian filmmaker Jawed Zayed. For more details, go to shubak.co.uk. Dubai's gallery Isabel van den Eind hosts the works by Sao Paulo-born Jessica Main and French-Algerian artist Abdelkader Benchama. Entitled Chromophobia, the exhibition combines Main's vibrant collages of salvaged billboards with Benchama's monochrome paintings. Chromophobia is at Gallery Isabel van den Eind until the 28th of July. And for the music lovers, we suggest the new Night and Day Festival, organized by the XX. Set in the scenic grounds of Hartfield House, just north of London, Night and Day features an impressive lineup of electronica and art pop, including John Hopkins, Polissa, and of course London's finest, the XX. The Night and Day Festival has been making its way across Europe after weekends in Lisbon and Berlin earlier this year. And now let's hear Polissa with Lay Your Cards Out. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
And that was Polissa with Lay Your Cards Out. They're playing at the Night and Day Festival in Hatfield House in London today.
It's time now for our weekly music review, and today I'm delighted to say we are welcoming someone who, despite being one of the key creative forces behind various successful music projects in Norway and beyond, rarely gets to share the limelight.
Mattis Witt is a Norwegian curator and producer and founder of the Pantarei project, which seeks to explore the common ground between contemporary classic and modern electronic music. One of his most recent projects was working with producer Panta du Prince to create the Bell Laboratory, a hypnotic orchestra of bell instruments centred around a huge 3-ton 50-bell carillon. If you're not sure what that sounds like, here's a little taster.
Panta du Prince and the Bell Laboratory there. Well, when Mattis isn't busy creating and curating projects like this, he's also a booker for Norwegian festivals, including Øya Festival, Ultima Festival, and Henie Onstad Art Centre, and is manager and label partner with Norwegian disco titan Todd Terje.
Well, here to tell us more about his busy life and to share some of his music with us and some other new music from Norway, I'm delighted to say Mattis joins us in the studio now. Welcome, Mattis.
Hello, hello. Thank you.
Maybe the best place to start actually is with the Bell Laboratory that we've just heard, which is wonderful. I know that we covered it on the Culture Show on Monocle 24 previously. But a project like that, I mean, where on earth do you get the idea to do something like that from in the first place?
Actually, I have almost no idea how it like first came around. But
just a lot of bells.
Just a lot of bells, really. Well, In Oslo, we have a bell tower, which is a pretty like vital point of contact for Oslo as a city as well. It's located on top of the city hall, and it sort of resonates throughout the city. So whenever you are in the city, each hour you hear a little bell concert. So it's a pretty, it's bells is something growing up in Oslo, you have a pretty like strong relationship to, and a conscious relationship to, because yeah, you just hear it all the bloody time.
But it's a very nice sound. In fact, in the current issue of Monocle, I've written a short piece about how one of the things that improves your quality of life is always having bells ringing somewhere.
Oh, wow.
Amazing. And yeah, I live next to Southwark Cathedral in London and love listening to the bells when I'm awake at night.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's a much nicer way of seeing what time it is than looking at the clock on your phone.
Exactly.
Well, when working here as Monocle 24, I've noticed it's really interesting what's going on in Norway at the moment when it comes to the music. And one of the artists you work very closely with is Dotteria.
Yeah, yeah.
And, well, you actually have a new song from him as well. Do you want to say something about this?
Yeah. Well, Oslo has had a strong electronic music scene for several years. It's, next to black metal, probably our main export of music. And that's we haven't really done pop music as well as Sweden and Finland, maybe, done.
It seems that there's interesting division of labor between the Nordic countries. Swedes are doing pop. I think Finns are still trying to do their hard rock death metal or whatever, and you are doing the electronic
stuff. I mean, you guys,
the
Swedes had to have so much pop music. I mean, you had ABBA, Lykkeli, Peter Björn and John, but we just really had AHA. That's sort
we
of...
had Lordi.
And Lordi, yeah.
And Annie?
Norway.
Oh, there's Norway, actually, yeah.
You don't get much popular than Annie. Nope. Should we listen to a little bit of Todd Terje? This is Strandbar.
That was Dotteria and Strandbar. It's a very interesting song. You've actually described yourself earlier that it's elevator music sounding single.
It is an elevator music sounding single, pretty consciously actually. It has a cool story to it because Dotteria's biggest hit to date is Inspector Norse. It's a bit of a, like a cheeky big disco tune that sort of dominated both clubs and airwaves throughout last year. But it had radio play all over the world, from BBC to Hong Kong to Japan, but not at all in Norway.
How is that possible?
I don't know. So it became sort of a big news story. I fed a little story about it to a news journalist, and it really blew up. It made front page that they wouldn't play this song. And actually, the main music executive of sort of the Norwegian equivalent to BBC went out and said that Inspector Norse sounded like music that could be played on a beach bar and therefore not could be played on radio. So what Terry did next was make a song called Strandbar, which translates to beach bar. Yeah.
Very nice indeed.
And has the Norwegian radio NRK P3, P3 is basically your youth radio station there, have they said anything?
Yeah, that the head of P3 was the guy that said this. So they sort of just blacklisted Dotteria for making too beachy-sounding music.
Mm. Well, talking about beachy-sounding music, we're going over to Barcelonian Balearic Collective. Yeah,
this
next.
Is actually,
do you want to give a little preview?
Yeah, this is actually a world premiere that I'm allowed to do today.
We're
it's
honored.
One of the more anticipated indie releases of this year.
When does it come out?
It's going to premiere on Tuesday. I'm not really allowed to play it the full song, but so I sort of just snuck it out of Matador, True Panther Sounds
very
Records.
Very sneaky preview then. Do you want to introduce it?
Yeah, this is DeLorean, which is one of my favorite sort of Balearic pop groups.
Thank you.
That was indeed new music from DeLorean. Spirit is the name of the track, and
I love it.
I love it too. Do you think? I think it's going to be big this summer.
I do think so. Barcelona have had a strong sort of electronic music, Balearic pop scene for many years with other artists like John Talabot that frequently tours with the XX and another guy called Pinal that released on Young Turks Records here in London. And DeLorean, I'm really happy DeLorean's return. It's been about 2 years since their last record, and yeah, this was the first listen. So
very nice, very transcendental. Yeah, takes me straight to a beach somewhere in midsummer.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Should we move on to your next selection? Tell us a little bit about Dornick.
Yeah, I moved to London about 4 or 5 months ago and sort of just trying to meet the music scene here. And I feel some of the more inspiring people in the music scene here is a record label and a crew called PMR Records, which is run by Ben Palmer. And he discovered artists like Disclosure that just went to number one. He discovered Jesse Weir. People like Julio Bashmore, and they're really not only putting their mark on underground music, but also really making it to number one in the charts. So I think it's a
commercial success as well as critical
acclaim. Yeah, it's an incredible, exciting time for underground music, and Ben has been the guy to sort of take underground music from the smaller clubs to the charts, and I have massive respect for that. So,
and Dornick is one of their latest finds?
Dornick is one of the latest finds. It's actually the drummer of Jesse Weir. And Something About You is his first track.
Well, let's have a listen.
I can see that sunshine in your eyes. And there's something about you. And there's something about you. Every time I wake, you're the first thing on my mind. Yeah. There's something about you. And when there's something about you, I just can't see myself without you. Girl, I'm hoping you hear me now, because I'm in every single word I say. I'm just hoping you feel the way that I do. I'm just hoping you say that I love you too. Girl, I'm hoping you hear me now, because I'm in every single word I say. I'm just hoping you feel the way that I do. Girl, I'm hoping one day you'll say I do. Every day I wish that I could get close to you. That's a plaguing truth. And there's something about you. I can't help but get jealous when dudes walk in you. Girl, something about you. Oh, there's something about you.
That was Dornick, Something About You. And here on The Review, we are joined by Mattis Witt, Norwegian curator and producer. And this is one of your favorite songs.
It is, ever? I think it's, I maybe wrote that, but it's definitely one of my favorite songs in recent time.
It's very good. There's something almost Michael Jackson to the voice.
Oh, very much so. A young Michael Jackson.
Young Michael Jackson, even. I love it.
Yeah, it's an amazing song, and it's perfect for the summer. And it came out about a week ago now. And I've just been playing it about 30 times a day, really.
Yeah, well, it's not the last time our listeners will hear it on Monocle 24, I can assure you.
It's great. Amazing additions to our playlist, indeed. If we move on, next artist is called Emily Nicholas.
Yeah, I think I wanted to bring some Norwegian music. Part of my job is to book two Norwegian festivals and an art center, so I get to listen to a lot of amazing new Norwegian music. I guess Norway is mostly famous for jazz music and black metal and electronic music, but we have a good core of young pop artists coming out, especially singers like Susanne Sundfør and Ingrid Olava that does really amazing pop piano music. Emilia is the newest addition to that crew. She's really young, and really like a tiny girl with a big voice.
How old is she?
She's 23. She's sort of like the, I kind of always compare her to Edith Piaf. She's a little woman with a strong attitude and a massive voice.
Exciting. Let's re-listen to Grown Up by Emilia Nicholas.
Thank you.
Emily Nicholas was the name. Grown Up was the name of the track, and our guest just before that said that she's Norway's version of Edith Piaf, basically.
Yeah, she won't like that, but it had to be said. Sorry, Emilia.
Mattis, we've probably got time for one final track. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the fifth song that you've picked out for us?
This is Nils Fromm. I've been traveling a lot this year with Panto the Prince and our Bell Laboratory project, and it has taken us around concert halls around Europe and the States and in Canada. And on several occasions, we've been as lucky to be billed together with Nils Fromm, which is an amazing pianist and a visionary composer. It's cool. There's very few artists that sort of like the Bell Laboratory and like the projects I've been working with. It's sort of in the crossing between the more established concert halls and classical music and the more modern alternative music. And there's only a few festivals that sort of focuses on that. So you kind of end up meeting the same people in each city around the world. And I think Nils Fromm is probably my favorite of those. He's just doing really incredible stuff in sort of a neoclassical way.
Well, Mattis Hvidt, Norwegian curator and producer, thank you very much for sharing your musical choices with us on The Review. We're going to say goodbye to you and listen to a bit of Nils Fromm on your way out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Minds to Teach by Nils Fromm there. That was the final choice of Norwegian curator and music producer Mattis Hvidt.
You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. It's time now to spin the globe and pick out a city to explore for some cultural highlights. Our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield has just returned from a trip to Athens, and here are some of his highlights for you if you are spending the weekend in the city.
It's Athens, it's the weekend, it's hot, it's summer. You can really feel the heat here in Athens this weekend. And what better way to start the summer than with a trip to see the wonderful Patti Smith. She is in town this weekend. Tickets are €25, a mere €5 for concessions. Go see her at the Odeon of Herodes Atticus. If you want to watch a bit of TV this weekend, I know that sounds a little bit strange for the city look ahead, but bear with me. Why not actually head down to the TV station of Greece, ERT? They may be technically off air, but the journalists and editors who face losing their jobs have made sure that the show carries on. If you go down there this weekend, you may well be entertained by the Symphony Orchestra of the ERT, who have been the face of this fight against the closure. Not playing, don't worry, there'll be other music too, and of course lots of protests, because at the moment that's what Athens is all about. The Resistance Festival, aptly named for Athens, takes place this weekend at the Agricultural University of Athens. Lots of music, lots of culture, and as you would expect, talks about politics and community. It's going to be one of the events where Athenians come together to talk about the current crisis. It starts 9:30, it's tonight, and it's also Sunday night. Do go down. And because it is summer and it really is starting to get hot here in Athens, the best thing to do is head to the beach. Either stay in Athens and go to one of the many beach bars, or of course, just head to an island. There are thousands. Go to an island. You know that's what you really want to do. So that is the weekend in Athens. And to play you out, let's have a little bit of Patti Smith. So, you know, if you can't go to a beach in Athens, you can at least listen to her now. For Monocle in Athens, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Was Steve Bloomfield's weekend rundown from Athens. There, you're listening to The Review on Monocle 24, and we'll be staying in Greece next, but this time in the comfort of a cinema.
Monocle 24 continues its global summer tour with a stop-off in Thailand. Next week, we'll be touching down in Bangkok for two very special editions of The Briefing. On Wednesday and Thursday next week, The Briefing will be coming live from the Thailand Creative and Design Centre, presented by Monocle's Editor-in-Chief, Tyler Brulé, and Editor Andrew Tuck. We'll be bringing you a snappy roundup of the current state of affairs in Thailand's creative scene, and meet the people, making waves in Bangkok's thriving design community. So tune into The Briefing at midday UK time and 1800 in Thailand, on Wednesday and Thursday next week, live from the Thailand Creative and Design Centre in Bangkok, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you are listening to The Review with me, Marcus Ipiantuco MacDonald.
18 years ago, Richard Linklater introduced us to characters Jesse, played by Ethan Hawke, and Celine, played by Julie Delpy, in his much-acclaimed romantic comedy Before Sunrise. The same pair returned 9 years later in 2004, 9 years older, though not necessarily any wiser, with the follow-up Before Sunset.
Fast forward to 2013 and the couple are back in the latest instalment, Before Midnight, as 40-somethings on holiday in Greece with two daughters and 18 years of emotional baggage.
Oh, we said we were going to stop. They wanted to see the ruins.
Yeah, but should we wake them up?
I don't know.
You know what, let's do? On our way back to the airport, we can catch them.
Hmm? You know we won't.
Yeah, probably not.
Okay. And how did you two meet?
We met about 18 years ago. We kind of, sort of, fell in love. And a decade later, we ran into each other.
No. You wrote a book, and I read about it and went to look for it.
It's pretty romantic. If we were meeting for the first time today on a train, would you start talking to me? Would you ask me to get off the train with you?
Of course.
It's been a much anticipated return, but has it been worth the wait? Well, here to give us his perspective is Professor Philip Horn from University College London, who, when he's not teaching students about the merits of Henry James, is also a film critic for the Telegraph newspaper and Sight and Sound magazine. Welcome to The Review, Philip.
Thanks.
Has it been worth the wait?
Very much so, yeah. It's quite a surprise in a way.
I couldn't believe it when it's 18 years since Before Sunrise. It makes me feel old.
When you think of the style of this film and compare it to the previous two, what's the difference?
Well, this is not a city film. The two previous ones, first one was in Vienna, the second one was in Paris. You were wandering through the streets. Now you're in the Greek countryside. It's really beautiful. There are ruins. There's the sea. There's a fantastic villa where they're staying, which belonged to the writer Patrick Leigh Fermor.
One of my favourite travel writers.
Yeah.
Philip, I want to ask you about a comment that you wrote about Before Sunset and your review of Before Midnight in Sight and Sound, where you say that it's a grown-up film for sensitive, decent, complicated people, which to me really hits the nail on the head of my relationship with the first two films, where I enjoyed them and I loved them, and they're films that I do hold quite dear, but at the same time, it's just something that keeps me a little bit distant from them. Maybe I'm not complicated enough.
Of course, Linklater started, he made his big impact in 92 with Slacker, you know, which is people walking and talking in Austin, Texas, which is his adopted hometown, and it's full of Austin weirdos. I mean, fantastic people with strange ideas and so on. And there's a little bit of that in still in these films. I think he calls it the walk and talk, where people are walking and developing ideas and they're playing with ideas and speculating.
But people have such strong relationships with the series. And I mean, it's reached fever pitch, the excitement. But Before Midnight, you've interviewed Richard Linklater twice.
Yeah.
How does he explain the sort of connection that people have to these films and why he's been successful in charting the course of a relationship that is so real, maybe where so many other people haven't been quite so successful?
Well, I think, I don't know about, I'm not sure he knows exactly why audiences love it, but I mean, what they do is, I mean, they're kind of really true to their own sense of the characters, because these films, I mean, particularly the second and third one, have been co-written by Linklater with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. I mean, they're all writers, they're all directors. Linklater has acted, of course, as well. So it's a very collaborative thing, and they're all pouring their own lives into these films and their own experiences. In fact, I wanted to ask him. I didn't actually ask him when I interviewed him.
I think,
how do you know all this about people? I mean, it's just sort of
it's uncanny,
full of things that ring true and to relationships and how quarrels start and things like that.
It's absolutely unique. If you've seen the first film when it came out, it's been about 18 years, if I don't do my maths all wrong now. And that's absolutely unique when you think of the relationship you have with the characters when you've watched the films and so on. And I think it's interesting also how the style in these films has slightly developed. In this one, there is actually a car scene that is as long as 14 minutes.
Yeah.
And you see this discussion. People just talk in the car. And the director has actually said to you that he wanted to give some kind of a bonus to the people who are watching the film.
Yeah.
How did he explain that?
Well, the kind of bonus he seems to mean is that it's like, you know, you've wanted these characters to get together for all these years, and now this is them living together, and it just has to seem real. So it's just kind of, you know, they've got their children asleep in the back of the car, they steal the child's apple while she's asleep, she hasn't finished it, you know, and but she's on the wife is on the phone, sorry, not Celine, who isn't his wife, is on the phone for half the scene, and so on. I mean, it's just like real life. It gives you that sense of
reality. When you watch that scene for 14 minutes, you actually get this feeling that you are there with them.
Yeah, and actually, I was thinking Linklater's a kind of very sporty guy. I mean, I think baseball is his thing. He's made a documentary about a baseball coach, and so he thinks of in terms of challenges and achievements, and I think making things look easy. So, you know, in the previous film before Sunset, there's a 9-minute car scene. So this time he had to
gearing up.
Next film there's going to be a 21-minute or something car scene.
But this is the third and final part. Also, we're led to believe, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know about final.
Really? He's left it open for...
I talked to him about that. I mean, actually, I didn't have room for it in the interview, but...
Will the next one be after lunch or something?
I suppose it would be... Yeah, well, that would be good. we move into the afters. But I suggested maybe it could be like a Hollywood comedy of remarriage. You know, those great 40s Hollywood screwball comedies, His Girl Friday and The Philadelphia Story, where the couple have broken up and then they're pulled back together again. Because in a way, you'd want some kind of edge.
Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and now Before Midnight, these first two have had a huge significance, and so many people have seen them. Can you see them influencing other films?
Ooh, I'd like to. I guess they might give people the courage to make films in which characters just talk and the drama emerges out of, you know, the kind of textures of everyday life. I'm actually going to see a preview of the new Noah Baumbach film tomorrow, Francis Ha. And I don't know if you've seen Greenberg or Margot at the Wedding or The Squid and the Whale.
I'm afraid not. They're
great little indie films. He wrote with Wes Anderson before he started making his own films. I mean, they've got something of this kind of courage to... I mean, they're funny and witty, but they're also quite dark and, you know, there's a bit of grit in the...
It's a sort of hyper... reality, I suppose, isn't it? That just lets real life and all its complexities speak for itself rather than having to dress it up.
Yeah, and Linklater was saying how what an amazing achievement it is for the actors to, you know, they've got this large crew. I mean, his walk and talk method, you know, the camera's on a steady cam and it's going backwards in front of the characters who're just strolling along talking. And there are all these people running around in front of them, sort of clearing things out of the way and tripping over and so on. And they have to pretend there's nobody there. It's just like they're going for a stroll in the country.
It's an amazing feat.
Yeah.
I don't want to spoil this film by, you know, revealing how it ends and so on, but if I would ask you to name your favourite scene from this film,
ooh,
what would it be?
Well, it builds and builds. I think probably the ending. I mean, it does get more and more intense, and you just don't quite, you know, you care so much about these characters, you really want them to stay together, but there's lots of stuff going on at the end, and you just don't know. He's always playing with the tone, isn't he, of kind of how
exactly.
serious this is. I mean, they're making jokes all the time, but, you know.
This is laced with great depth as well, that I think is probably what people recognise in it themselves,
yeah.
And those throwaway comments that say so much more than anything that you could sort of carefully craft about your relationship.
Yeah, and the way in a relationship, if you say something and then you realise it's been taken the wrong way and, you know, you wish you hadn't said it and kind of everything sort of spirals out
of control. I mean, how much do you think of Linklater himself we see in the film and the sort of development over the trilogy?
Well, I know he's had children himself, I think since the last... are they since the last one? Anyway, I mean, he's definitely got...
Stealing from his own life.
Well, yeah, I mean, he is an incredibly varied director, though. I mean, Bernie, his previous film, you know, it's just a very different thing from
A School
these
of Rock,
films.
Which it seems so incongruous.
Yeah.
Well, Professor Philip Horn, thank you so much for joining us here on The Review and taking us through the third in Richard Linklater's series, Before Midnight. That brings us to the end of our Saturday review, I'm afraid to say. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, researched by James Bullock, and our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week, best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with Robert Bound and Andrew Tuck.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Marcus Hippie. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great weekend. Goodbye.